Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and with me, as always, on the couch is my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished up watching Douglas Sirk's 1956 film, Written on the Wind.
Let's do a synopsis straight off the bat.
Yeah.
Do you want to do the honours?
Alrighty. So it tells the story of the Hadley Oil family, a giant kind of millionaire family who... the father kind of, you know, started this giant oil company, and we kind of focus on the two children of this family, in particular, the son. What the fuck's his name again?
Can you just call him son?
Yeah.
I can't remember either.
Damn it.
I know there's Mitch and the Hadleys.
And the Hadleys. Which I couldn't help but think, like, it's the Hadley boys.
Yeah.
Kyle.
Of course.
The son Kyle, who is a bit of a, you know, drunk playboy who falls in love with this young woman by the name of Lucy, and they get married, and sort of we're given a snapshot of their lives, and it as a sort of love triangle, or I guess almost love square or rhombus, I guess, because there are many different...
Yeah, it's like a square.
Yeah. Starts to develop and kind of tear this family apart.
We've got Mitch, the best friend, who
yes.
oversees, he's kind of...
The good son, we'll say.
Yeah.
Like, he's the son that the father never had, who actually, you know, has his head on straight and actually cares about the business and wants to help people out, versus the two drunker children who just seem to be like, we got money, it's all right, which are Kyle and Mary Lee Hadley.
Yeah, and Lucy's, that makes the square.
Yes.
It's an interesting film. It's like a nice character study.
Yeah, it's a marked difference to the Douglas Sirk Rock Hudson film we got last week, which was I guess the biggest difference I saw between the two is in All That Heaven Allows last week. We're given, again, similar snapshot, especially based around a romantic interest and things, where we get the clash between good people who are, like, really wonderful characters who are in support of this love, and then horrible characters who are against it. With this film, we are presented nothing but horrible characters, with the exception of probably Mitch and, to a lesser extent, Lucy, the wife. Every other character in this film is...
kind of corrupted.
Corrupted, yeah, and it makes it a really tough film to watch. Interesting, but tough.
It kind of reminded me of, like, an older Scorsese film. So at least some of the... I mean, like, I wasn't expecting it to get to be so... Not so much violent, but...
confrontational, I guess?
Yeah. It was like that. Like there's heaps of sequences when anyone pulls out a gun.
Yeah.
There's a sequence where the opening... I think it's within the first 20 minutes. Where you meet... It's the first meeting of... What's the sister's name?
Mary Lee.
Mary Lee. You first get an inkling of what she's all about when they're at a bar, and she's kind of coaxed this kind of criminal into a bar, and she's causing a fuss. And
yeah.
So they got to call Mitch down to kind of...
diffuse the situation.
Yeah.
Just take Mary Lee home. Like, she's up to her antics again.
Yeah, and although it's, like, it's an oil family, it really felt like a mobster family to some degree.
Yeah, well, I mean, they run a town, pretty much. Like, that's... when Lucy first is introduced to, you know, the father figure, the head of the Hadley family, he sort of says, like, you know, welcome to the family and welcome to the town, Hadley. Like, they've established with all their oil wells, like, a small fucking town in Southern California or whatever. So, it totally is a mob feel. Like, they own this town, and wherever, you know, whenever any of the Hadley kids gets into trouble, they either call Mitch to come and he's the fix-it man. Or, you know, they call the cops and they're just like, no, don't press charges.
Yeah, there's no consequences.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much explains the reasons why the kids are the way they are. They just,
they've
never been punished.
Yeah, I was just about to ask, do you think that's why these people are so corrupted? Is because they've, because of the wealth that they've experienced, and, like, you know, we're given, like, these little brief backstory things where, like, when they were 12 years old or something, Mitch and Kyle, Kyle convinces Mitch, like, let's break into the bottling plant and steal some beer. And, you know, they get caught, and it's all... Mitch takes all the blame, because, no, the Hadley boy can't be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's this idea... It's an interesting idea that this... it's, I guess it's that thing of absolute power corrupts absolutely, I guess.
Mm.
And it's just kind of doing that on a small character scale, I guess.
Yeah, there's undertones of something bigger there, but so the whole story is kept small because it's only interactions between really just four people.
Yeah, we just want to care about their romantic relationships and how they all interact and how that causes pretty much this whole thing to fall apart.
Yeah, so the question is, do you enjoy watching a love square?
Normally,
do you enjoy watching this love square?
We should really explain that. Yeah.
What the love square is in particular, because you have...
Okay, so you have...
Mitch is in love with Lucy because she's a very down-to-earth lovely lady.
Yep.
Lucy is not... is kind of in love with Kyle, but is more interested in... like, the adventure of it? It wasn't quite clear
There was never really much of a...
She marries Kyle, but it's like...
We're not really sure why.
She's supposed to be a good girl.
Yeah.
But she, I guess she's
It's the promise of him going down the straight and narrow.
Maybe she's like, you used to be a drunk and like a playboy.
She likes to change people.
I reckon I can change you, and that's my goal.
And whatever. He makes the promise that he will change for her. So I guess that's what kind of makes her enamored with him, I guess. But
it's a bit strange to me that she's just like flat out like, I'll marry her, and I'll
within
just
a day
for,
of knowing for, him as yeah, well.
Just hope for the best.
Yeah, yeah.
In any case,
all signs point to this being a bad idea. But yeah. You know, fuck it. You said drunk that you would change.
Yeah.
So we kind of veered off a little bit there, but it's yeah. So it's Mitch, the best friend, is in love with Kyle's wife,
Lucy.
Lucy.
Who's married Kyle for reasons
that
assumed
really
to be...
Clear, yeah.
She wants to change him into a better man.
Mary Lee, the younger sister of Kyle, is in love with Mitch.
Yes.
Who is just like, no, you are a fucking loose unit. I want... He uses the excuse that I grew up with you and I view you as a sister, which I just think is making an excuse for...
Yeah,
like,
I don't
want
put
crabs.
My dick in crazy.
Yeah, don't want to put my dick in crazy. Yeah,
so, you know, let's just keep it at that.
Yeah.
Stay away.
And I don't know about you, but I get like the slight inkling that Kyle is in love with Mitch as well to kind of complete that square.
Everyone's in love with Mitch because it's Rock Hudson.
Yeah, pretty much. So, yeah.
That's the love square.
And it takes its time and we slowly watch these characters disintegrate, I guess. With the exception of Rock Hudson, I guess, who instead of watching... letting himself be destroyed by the situation, decides to just take himself out of it, and decides he's going to, he has the line of, like, Tale of the Hadleys is his new motto, and he's decided he's gonna just cut ties with the family and move to a rival oil company, move to Iraq, and then just start anew, which is an admirable kind of solution, I guess, but,
yeah.
Kind of in amongst all of this, these decisions, we have the news, I guess the medical news that is Kyle is has, shall we say, weak swimmers, I guess.
Yeah, it's,
do we jump to that point?
His testicles don't work very well.
Yeah,
and they don't produce sperm, viable sperm, that much. But this is all just like a plot by plot.
Yeah,
synopsis. we're not really getting into the meat of this love square.
Hmm.
So let's try and do that.
Yeah. Easiest way to do that, I think, is did you find it? Were you entertained by it?
I was transfixed by the evil nature of Mary Lynn.
Yeah,
what a fucking name.
Mary Lee.
She's just so horribly. She's like Emperor Palpatine. She just gets so much
like
joy.
The evil flow.
Yeah, she just gets so much joy out of just being outright evil for no other reason than just being evil.
And instigating the evil things as well.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is jumping right the fuck ahead, but I mean, the kind of climax of the film, the final confrontation between Kyle and Mitch, she has no horse in that race, really, but she, just to get her pure evil rocks off, I guess, just jumps into the room to be like, I want to watch this shit play out.
Yeah.
Like, she's constantly doing that, just kind of like poking the bear, I guess.
It's fun to watch.
Yeah. But I personally had the problem that I found Kyle to be such a unlikable character that it kind of, to the extent that it disconnected me from caring about the romantic struggles between them. Cause
I felt like he was a strange, the actor was not kind of, I felt like the actor wasn't doing that character as much justice as he should. Like, he was so suave
and
well-spoken, but it didn't fit a kind of, like, recovering alcoholic. Like, you would think that you'd want to put more, a bit more nuance into the character, like a bit more of a broken past, a bit more of, like, a broken personality. But he was so measured when he was not drinking.
Do you think that was possibly Robert Stack, the actor, having to kind of compete with Rock Hudson in terms of charisma, I guess, and making it almost believable to the audience that Lucy would go for him versus going for Rock Hudson? Like,
he's still got to be a catch.
Yeah, to do that and kind of express that to the audience, he had to just lay the charm on so thick, and that was kind of all the character he was given, I guess, really.
So, maybe. Because it is hard to go up against Rock Hudson to compete against that guy.
That being said, I do think Robert Stack owns this film. He kind of... Rock Hudson really doesn't do much in this film. He's top billed. He and Lauren Bacall, so Mitch and Lucy, are the two top billed people in this film. But it really is the Hadleys that own this film in terms of the performances, I think.
But they're the instigators of all the drama.
Yes.
Like, Mitch his role is only ever going to be the pacifier. So I think that he's, like, because of that, his character can never have that opportunity to shine that over any of the other characters.
But on that same note, looking back at last week with All That Heaven Allows, in a similar vein, Rock Hudson's character there, it was the kind of pacifier character. He never was the one that wanted to instigate trouble or instigate any kind of tension, but he still managed to pop off the screen in an insane way that made me even want to question my sexuality.
Yeah, that's true.
Versus this week where he's just kind of is. Like, he just is there. Like, he really well illustrates the idea of a man who's kind of constantly having to live in the shadow of these rich pseudo-siblings and, you know, never get his own thing, which has the great character development where he decides he needs to break free and to hell with the Hadleys and become his own man.
Yeah.
That's really good, but other than that, there was not really... It was just kind of coasting.
Yeah.
He played the quiet straight man.
But it's quite a different film. I was going into it thinking that it might be like a romance, but it just wasn't a romance.
No, it is the furthest thing from it. Yeah.
So
this movie has miscarriages and murder.
So those two characters, Rock Hudson's characters from both of these films, are so different. Because you can be a pacifist in both films, but if you're a pacifist lover, like in the previous film, then it's saucy.
It makes for a more meaty character versus a pacifist who's just kind of a, you know, a guy who helps fuck-ups, I guess. Like, he's not really... He's being a pacifist for not really great reasons, so I guess, yeah.
He still wasn't really pacifist because he's kind of, like, prepared to shoot people and...
That's true, you know, he finally takes action towards the end, yeah. Pacifist probably isn't the right word, but... Well, I mean, do we want to stick on the character option here and start maybe dissecting? We'll work our way through the main four. So,
okay.
Do you want to jump? We'll go from there straight onto Lauren Bacall, I reckon. Lucy.
Yeah.
Who is a very interesting character. We're kind of introduced to her, and right from the get-go, they establish her as someone that you should actually really care about and is interesting. Kyle sweeps her off her feet, theoretically. And
he attempts to. Like, it's kind of a stumbling, bumbling mess.
He's doing his Playboy shtick, where he offers to buy the advertising firm she wants to work at, takes her in his private jet, flies her down to Miami, and, you know, sets it up where the hotel room that she's staying in is filled with roses, and all the drawers are filled with jewelry and purses and a brand new wardrobe. And she's just like, wow, this is extravagant, and leaves.
Yep.
Which is wonderful. Like, you're established... This is a strong, independent woman who can't be bought. Like, I remember when we were watching it, we were both sort of saying that this is really gross, and if she goes along with this, like, you know, we could just flat out call her a prostitute. Like,
yeah, at what point do you call her a prostitute when you accept that many gifts from a rich man?
Yeah, for clearly sexual favours. Like, that's what's implied.
It's the barter system.
Yeah. But no, she turns around in the next scene and has gone home. She's gone to the airport and is like, I can't be bought. That's not what I care about in a relationship. And we're like, wow, this is a really wonderful character. But for me, I think that's kind of where her development ended.
Yeah, I agree. Because her decision to do that makes Mitch fall in love with her, makes Kyle attempt to change his ways to, instead of being a playboy, say, I want marriage and kids now. I want, like, to settle down with this woman.
It's the catalyst for the entire kind of narrative, I guess, from this point. And...
But then where does it go from there? He says, I'm going to change for you. And she goes, all right, fuck it. Let's go.
Let's get married. Like, yeah.
The next day.
The next day. They've known each other 36 hours, maybe.
So it doesn't... To me, that, like, this is probably the biggest flaw for me in the whole film is, like, she is being conservative 1 minute and being measured and thinking about her circumstance. And then the next day, it's completely destroyed by a 50-50 chance on this guy that may or may not be a drunken asshole.
Yeah, which, if, you know, history is correct, is a drunken asshole. And, like, if he's done this to her, like, on a whim this evening, like, how many times has he done this in the past just for a little bit of tang?
Yes, it's a good question.
Yeah.
So then I'm like, all right, so... Yeah, she was cool in that last scene, but why does everyone like her now? Because she just flipped her shit.
Yeah.
Jump boat.
I think it makes... it works to make Mitch intrigued by her to the extent that, yeah, she does establish herself as being different than all the other girls that go along with Kyle. But I guess we're meant to be along... Like, it's... She's the facsimile for the audience, I guess. Like, she's our gateway into this world, and we're kind of along for this ride with her, okay. I suppose.
Yeah, but, yes.
But if she is supposed to be our kind of introduction and our kind of guide into this world, you'd want a little bit more to do. Like, she just kind of is, once, you know, they get married and they move, you know, she moves into the Hadley estate and becomes part of the family, she's kind of really relegated to a background character while we watch Kyle slowly disintegrate. Like, mm-hmm. It would have been really interesting to actually have some scenes showing her go to the doctor or go to Kyle, Mitch, or go to the father and say, look, he started drinking again. He started doing what he promised he wouldn't do.
Mm.
And this is causing hell in the relationship and yada yada. But we're never given any of that.
And it's not a even... It's kind of a short film. You don't have to... You can't add that stuff and it's not going to drag it out.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been 5 minutes and it would have been like, okay, cool. We actually see that she cares about the relationship. And because she keeps saying she's not in it for the money. She's in it because she loves Kyle. But we're never really shown that.
You're not shown it. You're right, she's always in the background, but the only thing she's doing for the second half of the film is being an object of jealousy for Kyle, because Kyle's thinking that
she's there.
Mitch is going after her and she's going after Mitch.
Yeah,
but you never, I mean, you trust that she isn't, because you definitely trust that Mitch isn't.
Yeah.
But you're right, there's never...
Because there are two honourable characters in this film, and in this world, and yeah. I don't know, it's an interesting one. Do we want to jump from here actually onto the Hadleys themselves?
Yeah.
No, I think we... I mean... Kyle, like, I think we've gone into, like, you know, a lot by discussing, obviously, Mitch and Lucy. We, you know, extemporaneously end up talking about Kyle in that, that he... He's the character that has, you know, at the beginning says he is going to change, but, you know, we're given his struggle that he cannot, like, and it's supposed to be a self-destructive story, I guess, but it's...
Well, I think you only get... He's destroyed himself.
Yeah.
On the grounds that he thinks... I mean, and this comes out at the very end, right before he accidentally shoots himself.
Yeah.
That he's always felt small next to Mitch.
Yeah.
Because Mitch, although he's not a son of old man Hadley, has always been the son of old man Hadley in old man Hadley's eyes, and it's diminished Kyle's manhood.
Yeah, the confidence, I think, is a good way to put it. Like, it kind of establishes,
or his self-respect, I think, really.
Like, it would have been nice if, because that, I mean, obviously comes out in a big bad way in the final moments of the film, with, you know, right before the incident with the gun. But it would have been cool if that had been, you know... You get little seeds of the idea planted earlier on, but it's never really properly explored until that moment. Like, it would have been nice if... The scene where Kyle and Lucy come back from their honeymoon, and they come into the office of old man Hadley, and he's sitting there in the middle of a meeting with Mitch.
Mm.
And he's got, like, Mitch, pull up a chair, my boy! And they're, like, you know, all buddy-buddy and stuff. It would have been nice, again, if there was an added moment in there where you could see that bothered Kyle. That, you know, yeah. his pseudo brother has been, you know, taking the role of him, I guess.
Yeah, you're only really told that stuff.
Yeah.
You never, that's what I mean by Kyle could have put on these, there's like the character could have been a bit more nuanced, you know.
Yeah.
Show these little bits of like bits of pain from his past and stuff like that.
Yeah, even a look or something would have sufficed, I reckon, but
It's still not, like it's still a really good film.
Yeah, it's totally entertaining, but and I think the thing that makes it entertaining is the performances by Robert Stack and Dorothy Malone, who plays Mary Lee, like those two just fucking up, I think, is what makes it entertaining. And like, the in particular Mary Lee, she is such a batshit crazy character that whenever she's on screen, you're like, what are you going to do now?
Yeah.
Like, you're just kind of transfixed by her insanity, I guess.
That freak show that is.
Yeah, yeah. And especially at the end, like, that final shot where it's like Mitch and Lucy drive off together, and she's just left wearing a fucking business pantsuit in her dad's office. It's like, wait, you're running the company now?
Yeah.
What the fuck? So, yeah.
Who else?
Well, I mean, like, I wouldn't mind narratively jumping to the third act now, I guess, if... Like, yeah, I mean...
Yeah, you mean, like, the... Kyle's
Kyle's death and then the ensuing trial.
The suicide and then the trial.
All yeah. Right. I think that'd be that's kind of where the film really gets going. Like for the first hour it's just, you know, character study and like watching the how these relationships interact, and it's in this last half hour that it really disintegrates, and that's when we find out Kyle starts drinking again because all he's ever wanted is to have a kid. And he finds out that he has, you know, weak sperm.
He's like almost sterile.
Almost sterile. Again, one of those another nitpicky thing. We find out secondhand through Lucy in an offhand comment to Mitch, like, you know how Kyle's always, you know, always wanted kids and it's what he's always dreamed of. Well, naturally. It's like, well, wait, what?
What about all this Playboy stuff?
Yeah, we've been told this like 20 minutes after he's been told he's sterile and he's started to become an alcoholic again. Like, it would have been interesting to establish that at the beginning,
when,
the
when it was yeah. necessary to establish.
Yeah, that. Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a mess like that. But needless to say, like that's what is the catalyst for his, you know, downfall, and he starts drinking everything again. But Lucy becomes pregnant, which adds in the kind of the drama that he thinks that
he's so convinced
it turns into Days of Our Lives.
Yeah,
all
it,
of a sudden.
It really is rather melodramatic.
Just trying to explain it turns into a fucking soap opera. Where
he hates himself so much that he just has convinced himself he can never have a kid. His testicles are so fucking fucked up.
Yeah.
That he can't have a kid. It's not possible. It must be Mitch's kid.
So he thinks his wife has gone and slept with his best friend, gotten pregnant. They've hatched this scheme that they will have sex, get her pregnant, and be like, oh, look, you did it, Kyle.
Good on you, mate.
Yeah.
Stop drinking.
Which is insane and pretty entertainingly so.
Yeah.
But in a fit of violence, he ends up being like, this is what he thinks, and ends up slapping her around and causing it.
I think he punched her in the stomach because
she has a miscarriage.
And you can't really get a miscarriage from a slap in the face.
And a falling over a bed.
Yeah, it's like, but then she screams again to be off camera, so I assume that, although they didn't show it, he probably punched her in the stomach or something.
Yeah. So,
in a fit of drunken rage.
Yeah, which, you know, eventually leads to a confrontation between Mitch and... The confrontation between Mitch and Kyle, which ends in Kyle accidentally shooting himself and die. Which...
Well, yeah, I mean, he's threatening Mitch.
Yeah.
And Mary Lee decides...
She's going
to
intervene.
I've got to save Mitch.
Yeah.
Slap the gun out. Struggle with the gun. Try and get it out of Kyle's hand. Kyle struggles and accidentally shoots himself in the gut and dies later.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, all right, surely the death of Kyle is going to defuse the situation. Everyone's going to sober up and fucking be like, what is going on? We better check our shit.
Yeah.
But then Mary Lee's like, here's a fucking outcome I can conjure
up. Here's an ultimatum for you.
Yeah. What if I threaten, I blackmail good old Mitch my fave? That if he doesn't marry me, I will say that he killed Kyle and put him in jail forever.
Because her rationale is the dumbest thing ever, that if we were to be married, I can't testify against you because a wife can't testify against her husband.
Yes, but I'm
that is some Arrested Development logic right there. Yeah. That is retarded.
Yeah.
Like, why is that a thing that she thinks exists?
What kind of marriage would that be? It's like, why'd you get married? Oh, it's blackmail.
Yeah, and that's also the thing of like, yeah, totally, like, is her theory like, I'm going to blackmail him into marrying me, because then once we're married, he'll love me. Like,
yeah.
No, he's got it, right? I mean...
Kyle changed.
Oh, yeah.
He'll change too. It'll be fine.
You know, it's fine. He'll get to know the real drunk and slutty me.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, he'll realize I'm the life of the party and we are good to go.
Yeah.
That's also when she gives him all the STDs and he's just like, well, fuck, I guess I gotta...
There's no STDs in the 50s yet. It's not until the 80s.
That's what history has told us.
No, but I thought it was sweet because that's the tension of the trial. Is she going to...
Yeah.
Is she going to go that far? Is she going to take that final leap and put her... We assume she loves Mitch. Put her love in jail just because she can't have him.
If I can't have him, no one can. And my problem...
But it's even worse than that because it's like you're going to rob him of his freedom. Not even the freedom to have... A love with somebody else.
No, yeah, you're literally going to put him in jail for life.
That's pretty evil.
And it's the 50s, it might have even been the death penalty, because this guy was a millionaire and he killed him.
Oh, yeah.
But, to me, the problem with that, the whole courtroom thing, was that the stakes were so low for me, like, as a viewer, because I was like, it's Rock Hudson. Like, and it's not going to happen. We've got 10 minutes left in this film. There's no way if the studio didn't let Douglas Sirk end All That Heaven Allows on the ambiguous note of he might be dead, there's no fucking way they are going to end this film with him being accused of murder. Like, that's just not going to happen. Like,
would it make it a better film if she was just like, oh yeah, Mitch killed him, and then the end?
And it's him being arrested and taken away.
Yeah.
I would be like, that is a ballsy move.
That's very bold.
But I had a giant problem with the whole trial scenario in that I guess it was the way in which the Hadleys owned the town that this was operating, but the judge was only accepting evidence that made Mitch look guilty.
Yeah.
He
was only asking questions that were skewed towards incrimination.
And then when someone, I think it was Lucy, said, like, Mitch didn't kill my husband, he's like, no, 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 that's inadmissible. We're not going to allow that.
Yeah.
It's just like, but what? You asked her one question, the wife of the deceased.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It never came into the fact that he beat her up and caused her to have a miscarriage, which would, you know, put him in jail, theoretically.
Yeah, but if I reckon the judge would be thinking, what's, like, the path of least resistance? If we protect the Hadley family, we effectively protect
the town.
The town
establishes... Yeah, yeah.
So that's probably what he's thinking.
Yeah.
Although that's not his job.
Yeah. But again, it's one of those things, like, I guess we are to assume that. We're never actually explicitly told or shown that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Not even subtly, like, artistically shown.
No, no. But, yeah.
Let's just finish up with that. Mary Lee does in fact have a character arc.
She has a soul, it
yes.
turns out.
And she decides to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And save Mitch's soul and hers too.
And Mitch and Lucy drive off into the sunset together.
Yeah.
The end.
But
the very unsatisfying end.
Yeah, it doesn't really Is there a meaty point to it? Is there like a
That's what
message?
I was wondering. That this whole time I was thinking what is the point to all of this? And I'm struggling to find one other than...
Is it like a cautionary tale? Is it just
yeah,
simply a roller coaster ride that you jump on and then get off and you go, oh, well, that was fun?
I think it is. I think it is just a cautionary tale in, like I said earlier, the idea that absolute power corrupts absolutely. Like, the idea of people being allowed to do whatever they want consistently, like the Hadleys have, breeds corrupt people. And if they don't learn to change their ways, they're all doomed, and everyone around them is doomed.
But old man Hadley didn't feel like that.
I know, because he sort of had life as a poor child,
okay.
And he had established his wealth, whereas his children were born into the money and were corrupted from the word go.
But wouldn't Mitch have been able to take advantage of that situation too, because he's practically family?
But he still was always viewed as the poor friend and still lived with his dad in the... He didn't live at the Hadley's house. He still...
Okay.
He was just the best friend who happened to be the poor kid.
Hmm.
And he was always reminded of that fact. Like, when they break into the... When they get caught breaking into the bottling plant, the guy says, that's what you get for... The Hadleys get for hanging out with poor white trash. Like, and he... And, yeah. and even Kyle himself, like, right before when he wants to shoot Mitch, says... Calls him poor white trash. It's like constantly something that's been hammered home to Mitch that's what he is. He is not that, which I think helps establish, like, helps him keep a good head on his shoulders, I guess, in terms of that, and not be corrupted.
Should the film have? It seems like if it's going down that route, then should the film suggest that you can be? It seems like it was suggesting that if you're rich and you're given everything you want, you will be corrupted. There's nothing, like, there's no personality or no individual choice that you can make that will get you out of a corrupted mind.
Yeah.
Or off that route towards corruption. The film never gave you, like, an indication that there might be an alternative...
No.
...way?
Which is the problem of making it really hard to establish what this film is actually saying.
Yeah.
Like, because there's no counter kind of explored for that, I'm not even sure that is the message being said, really. Yeah.
So I don't know what to think about the film.
Yeah.
I do. I loved a lot of the acting. Mm. I thought that the camera work was kind of boring on the whole.
There were some interesting shots, in particular the use of mirrors and pans. Yeah, there was a lot of kind of well-framed shots. And, I mean, it was very pretty to look at, like, in terms of the colour palettes and things used. But, it was fine. There was nothing really that stood out.
I can't really recall anything that's, like... I could be, you know, there could be... shots that I wasn't paying attention enough to.
Yeah.
But it was stuff like you would watch a dialogue going on.
Yeah.
And it was very flat, just someone's talking, there's their face, then you switch to the other side. And
or periodically we'd pan over and they'd be framed within a mirror or something like that. And it's, you know...
There's nothing too complex about it. Like, there's no camera work that's suggesting giving any more depth to whatever's being discussed or shown or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And on the whole, I don't want to be too critical.
Yeah, like, I think we've been... The way we approached this episode was, because we had a tough time with the film, was to dissect the narrative and the characters and try and find where we had issues with it versus kind of praising the positive aspects of it. And by doing that, we've made it sound like a bad movie. It's not a bad movie.
No, it's well above average.
Yeah.
It's worth seeing, in fact.
But I think possibly, you know... there were those few slight character issues that made it a little bit hard to establish what the film was doing. And I think coming off of... I hate comparing it to last week's one continually, but, you know, last week was a very clear message and what the film was doing and was fucking almost flawless film versus this one, same director and things, but slight, those niggling side little problems that made it a little bit harder to kind of go along with, I think. But... Not a bad film at all.
I think like nowadays, if you would redo this film, you'd probably get a bit more of a backstory to the kids. There'd probably be sequences where they'd be actually kids.
Yeah.
Because there is a sequence where Mary Lee is reminiscing about the old times next to a lake.
Yeah, and
you're given audio of what's happening as she's thinking, which is that was nice. Like, in a sense, like, that's pretty much exactly what I want.
Yeah.
To happen. But maybe more of that, or maybe actually not just the audio of it while she's sitting there reminiscing, but actual flashback or actual, like, you know,
yeah,
taken back to the time.
I can't help but think that this one was trying to maybe be a little bit of a Great Gatsby kind of style thing, and it just kind of missed the mark a little bit, possibly.
It's still recommendable.
Yeah, but I guess on that note, do you want to hear a little bit of trivia about it?
Yeah, let's do some trivia.
So the film was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, including Best Original Song and Best Supporting Actor for Robert Stack, who played Kyle. And it actually won Best Supporting Actress for Dorothy Malone, who played Mary Lee.
Yeah.
She won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar.
Yeah, she's probably my favourite.
Mm. She was also nominated for the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress, but did not win that one. The movie was rumored to be based on the death of tobacco heir Zachary Smith Reynolds, the younger son of tobacco magnate R.J. Reynolds. The 20-year-old playboy had complete disinterest in the family business, an inexhaustible allowance, and a volatile temper. Smith owned a plane and literally stalked Broadway musical star Libby Holman until the 27-year-old singer married him in 1931. Their marriage was a clash of wills, and during an alcohol-fueled July 4th holiday party in 1932 at the family estate, Libby announced that she was pregnant. Stories differ, but there was reportedly a tense confrontation and a gunshot, and the young Smith was dead. Libby and Ab Walker, a close friend of Smith's, who was whispered to be her lover, were indicted for murder. Fearing scandal over the son's activities, the intensely secretive Reynolds family persuaded, that's in quotations, authorities to drop the charges. The death was finally officially ruled as a suicide.
Mm.
So, that is the inspiration for this story, I guess.
Great.
Douglas Sirk wanted it to be stated that Kyle Hadley was gay in the film. However, this could not be mentioned directly due to the Hays Code, the kind of censorship board at the time.
No gays allowed in film?
Yeah.
Is that a fucking rule back then?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Jesus.
Nevertheless, it is still implied that Hadley is secretly in love with Mitch. Which?
Well, you called.
I just
made a little statement on that, didn't
you? Yeah.
I didn't pick that up. My gaydar is fucking bad.
I think it was more leaned upon the idea that he idolized Mitch. And Mitch was a kind of representation of what he wanted to be versus not necessarily what he wanted to have.
Yeah.
Humphrey Bogart was unimpressed by the film and advised his then-wife Lauren Bacall to not make another film like it. He was not a fan.
Fair enough.
Mm. According to Dorothy Malone, Rock Hudson helped her with her performance. She said that she loved Sirk as a director, but there was one day where he couldn't get through to me. Quietly and patiently, Hudson took Malone aside and, because he had already had some experience working with Douglas Sirk, was able to make her understand what the director was trying to tell her. So, just more trivia that explains that Rock Hudson is the man.
He's a dude.
And finally, the last bit of trivia, Robert Stack, who obviously played Kyle, said that he did no research to prepare for his difficult role.
Well, yeah. What are you supposed to take from that?
This is a quote from him. I just went in and used my imagination, and I was doing DTs and madness and the six stages of drunkenness, and it was a good chance to truly prove that I could either do something pretty good or completely fall on my face. Stack got so involved in his part that Lauren Bacall, enacting the scene where he had to knock her over the bed and induce the miscarriage, became a little worried. As Stack later related that Bacall had told him, "You're crazy, your eyes are crazy," and Stack told her that his character was supposed to be crazy, to which she replied, "No, I don't mean you're acting, I mean that you are really crazy."
Yeah, okay. So, well, yeah, that's funny that he would not prepare.
No, and he's just like, "Oh, just wing it."
But then he got nominated.
And they got an Oscar nomination for it. So I guess it worked for him,
but,
I guess.
Yeah, but nah. I think I'm going with he could have done a more nuanced character if he had done the fucking study.
Agreed. I think he could have really brought something interesting to it. But yeah, unfortunately, he was a little bit lazy, I guess.
Was there any indication that, like, if you can subtly put in like an idea that Kyle is in love with Mitch artistically? You can say it without saying it?
Yeah.
And the film, was there anything like that in the film? Did you pick up anything like that?
Not really.
Because you did,
like,
say that. But
I think what I got from it was what I said earlier, the idea that Mitch represented what he wanted to be, not necessarily what he wanted to physically have, or that he was in love with the idea of what Mitch represented to everyone else, not necessarily in love with Mitch physically. That's kind of what I picked up from it. So that's where that, how I said earlier, the kind of square of, like, why he's in love with Mitch. He's in love with what Mitch represents, not him physically.
When did the whole gay, like, no homosexuals be allowed in film thing get pissed off?
I'm not sure.
We've come a long way. We've come from that
To
like a cowboy spinning in their palm,
yeah,
their hands.
Yeah, but that still lost the Academy Award for Best Picture to one of the worst films to ever win Best Picture.
What was that?
Brokeback Mountain lost to Crash, that race relation.
Brokeback Mountain is so much better.
So much better. It won Best Director, but did not win the Oscar because gays.
There's still a little bit waiting.
Yeah. Trying to find out when the Hays Code was actually first kind of eliminated. Fuck you.
I'm guessing like the 70s.
1968, after several years of minimal enforcement, the outdated production code was replaced by the MPAA film rating system.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess on that note, we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still in print as a one-disc DVD, but unfortunately is not available on to stream through iTunes or Hulu. But the DVD does come with the following special features. The Melodrama Archive, an annotated filmography of director Douglas Sirk with hundreds of behind-the-scenes and production photos, plus vintage lobby cards, as well as original theatrical trailers for Written on the Wind and All That Heaven Allows, as well as the usual kind of booklet and essays. So it's a fairly skint edition.
Mm.
A scant edition, I should say. But yeah.
Oh.
I guess any final thoughts on this one?
I don't have any. I'm sorry.
No.
Nothing.
I'm in agreement with you on that one. But I guess that'll wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Douglas Sirk's 1956 film, Written on the Wind. If you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, or if, I know, you saw something that indicated the gay relationship between Mitch and Kyle more than we did, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest. But other than that, we will be back next week when we look at the classic Spike Lee film, Do the Right Thing.
Ooh, that's exciting.
I am looking forward to this one. But for this week's episode, I am Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.